From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last fall, the Salt Lake Tribune published an editorial saying Utah's Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control, the DABC, had done at least one thing right lately. They hired a certified wine educator. But with one step forward, the paper wrote, there were at least two steps back. A recent state audit called out the department for antiquated inventory control. It raised questions about the amount of money lawmakers were giving to the operating budget, which meant high turnover and low pay for department employees. And that doesn't even get you to the Zion Curtain Rule and other quirks in the state's regulation of alcohol. Today in the program, we're talking about this system of laws that govern alcohol in the state today. Are they driven by logic and reason, or culture and morality, or all of that? Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard not to get emotional about Utah's liquor laws. Take the Zion Curtain, which, of course, you know about. It's a partition the state requires of restaurants that serve alcohol. If you're mixing a drink, you have to be behind this curtain. But take the emotional part out of it and just look at the logic. The idea behind the curtain seems to be this: kids or people struggling with alcoholism, being exposed to someone making a drink is by itself harmful. And here's the logic: being exposed to drinking or people making drinks increases the consumption of alcohol. And the more consumption you have, the more problems. Problems in the way of alcoholism, automobile fatalities, and other injuries and accidents. But does that logic hold up to scrutiny? That's part of what we're talking about today. What is it that drives Utah's liquor laws? That's sort of the essence of the conversation. How much of this is logic? How much of this is culture or morality? Joining us first on the program is Derek Monson. He's the public policy director at the Sutherland Institute. It's a conservative public policy think tank here in Utah. He's joining us by phone right now, joining us from his home in Farmington. His wife just had a baby, and that's why he couldn't sort of be with us here. Derek Monson, welcome to you, and congratulations.
Thank you very much, Doug.
I wanted to begin with how you're perceiving sort of the stakes of this case. I mean, let's start with the perception, the idea that, and we'll get to the particulars of the Zion Curtain here in a moment, but the idea that it's just so absurd. You're making restaurants go through these expensive hoops. The perception idea, it has no logic. There's no rationale to it. Give me your sort of broad sense of that first.
Well, you know, I think the logic behind it was really something bigger than, say, shielding people from seeing alcohol. You know, it was, I think, the fundamental logic, and this applies throughout the alcohol law system, is we don't want kids in bars. And so I think the reverse of that is it applies to the Zion Curtain, Zion Wall, however you want to call it, is if we don't want kids in bars, why do we want bars in our restaurants where there are kids? And, you know, and then we decided that, we actually don't want that because we don't want kids in bars. And, you know, there's good reasons for that. Kids are very susceptible to messaging, to what they see and how it's portrayed to them. You know, there's reasons, for example, that we put restrictions on the marketing of alcohol to minors. And this is one form of marketing is how you display your alcohol, how you portray it, how you show it, in the same way that it's marketing, for instance, how we portray set up food in grocery stores. You know, there's a reason it's on a certain level. It's because they want you to buy certain things more than others.
So take me through the logic of the Zion Curtain rationale, then. A young person who sees someone behind a counter making a cocktail will be exposed to drinking and therefore see it as normalized, as okay, and therefore down the line will consider drinking possibly in a situation where they may not have had they not been exposed to things like that. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think maybe a good analogy for it is to look at how oftentimes things are marketed, say alcohol, right? You'll see a beer commercial where people are just drinking, having fun, and or, you know, they're attractive people, they're cool people, they're at a party, something like that. And so the messages being sent are drinking is hip, it's fun, it's cool. Well, okay, so now go to a bar, and why do people go to bars? Well, they go to bars to have fun because it's hip. It's what you do on a Friday night, right? You go bar hopping or whatever, and that's what's going on. It's marketing as much as it is anything. It's an experience for people, and so okay, take that experience and put it then into a restaurant where kids are seeing, everybody's seeing it. Is that going to have an impact? Well, in as much as going into a bar is going to have an impact on a child, then having a bar and a restaurant should be the same logically, it seems to me.
There's this term in a paper written by a colleague of yours at the Sutherland, and I'm sure you're familiar with it. It's called morphing.
Yeah.
Explain what that is. The paper says that the Zion curtain laws, there's this kind of morphing going on. Tell me how that works, if you would. Just take me through what that is first.
Sure. Yeah, morphing is it's a term that's kind of documented in research of folks who watch the alcohol industry and see how the industry functions. And it's this phenomenon where it's particularly something that's happening in California, where in the evening hours after, kind of just later on in the evening, restaurants will start to market themselves, portray themselves like bars in order to compete with the bar scene. And so they kind of morph into bars in those hours. And one thing that prevents restaurants from doing that is a partition requirement because, we have other requirements in Utah on restaurants such as ratios of food to alcohol sales and intent to dine and things. But there's kind of ways you can get around those things if you didn't have some partition in terms of this morphing. You could kind of try to sell more alcohol in the evening if you sold more food during the day, for example, and those kinds of things. But the partition requirement really stops morphing in its tracks because there's really no way to act like a bar when you can't act like a bar. You can't openly mix your drinks and like a bar does. And I think it actually hits at another core piece of the logic behind the partition, which is that we wanted to distinguish between a bar and a restaurant. So say when a family wants to go to a place where, they'll know what experience they're going to get, they can go to a restaurant. Whereas if someone wants to go and go get a drink with their buddies and have a good time, they know they can go to a bar for that. And so we tried to draw that line, and as it impacts morphing, it kind of prevents that from happening, which is a good thing.
You've called that that sort of line of reasoning kind of a safe space. You're trying to create a safe space for people who don't want to be exposed to it.
Yeah, and I think that probably is most impactful. I mean, we talk about families all the time, but one group that we don't talk about a lot that we probably should talk about more in this context is recovering alcoholics. I personally had some conversations with folks who had alcohol abuse problems in their past, and they've told me that when they go into a restaurant or a bar or any kind of setting where they're openly mixing and serving drinks, the addiction just kicks right in, and it's they're at a constant fight at that point. I mean, that's just how addiction works. And so for a group like that, that is particularly vulnerable, I think it's completely reasonable to say that those folks should have a safer space. I mean, of course, they're still going to see alcohol, people drinking alcohol in restaurants, but do we have to just say, it's just going to be flaunted in your face and you just got to deal with that? Again, it's kind of a reverse actually on some of the arguments that are put against the alcohol laws, which are, we want to allow folks who want to drink the opportunity to go and drink the way that they want, whether they're coming from out of town and it's a tourism thing or whether they live here and they just want to be able to go and have the experience they want drinking. It's the same kind of argument there. We ought to allow the folks who are recovering from alcoholism, who are doing the right thing, the ability to go have the experience that they want. And the partition does that.
So it sounds to you that this is pretty self-evident, that if you put you know, the cocktail station at a restaurant behind an opaque partition, it will decrease exposure. It won't make a sort of traumatic experience for recovering alcoholics or young people, and therefore consumption will go down. But do you have any actual numbers, any actual evidence, any data to back that up?
Well, I mean, most of the alcohol laws, if we're being honest, don't really have data to back them up one way or the other, whether they're good or whether they're bad. What we do have is outcomes and data on the whole system.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is actually just a general reality in public policy. Oftentimes, we don't have data on every particular law, or we've controlled for every other element. You know, it just is more of a rarity, particularly in areas like this. And I think but what those outcomes show is that Utah's system of alcohol laws are doing pretty good at protecting people from excessive drinking and underage drinking. It's not perfect, you know, in particular, our young people have a tendency that when they go and drink, the data says they tend to binge.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we can be better, obviously. But we do have data saying the system is working generally at protecting public health and public safety. And on the other side of that coin, providing people reasonable access to alcohol. There are literally, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of places you can go get a drink in the state of Utah. So it's not like we're blocking everyone from getting alcohol.
But you know the counter to that, though, is of course, you know, look, people are saying, Derek Monson, it's not that your policies are so wise and so efficient that they're that those outcomes that you just talked about, that's not what's causing it. What's causing
sure.
it is the fact that this is a state that has a predominant religion that believes that drinking alcohol is immoral, that most Utahns, or a significant portion of them, certainly 60-plus, 70%, are Latter-day Saint, don't drink, that it has nothing to do with the actual efficacy of the laws or the regulations, but the sheer fact that there's a cultural dynamic at play.
Yeah, and to me that's always been an odd argument, because basically you're trying to say the law doesn't matter. And if that's the case, then you're effectively, logically, saying we could just repeal all our alcohol laws and there would be no difference. But I don't think anybody really believes that.
I know, think like, what people are saying, though, Derek, is right. And I don't think people who think that the Zion Curtain is ridiculous think that you should then do away with all laws. But what they're saying is the Zion Curtain is ridiculous. That does not seem to get at, and you can't really say with any sort of evidence that it's getting at the problem, that there are ways to reform these liquor laws. Like, for example, the club, you used to have to get this card for a club, and we've done away with that. And I think what people are saying is this is another one of those absurd things that don't do away with all the laws, just do away with the ones that they perceive as kind of silly.
Well, I think I would push back a little bit on that there's no evidence. You know, there's actually been several quotes from restaurant chain owners or individual restaurants saying that if you got rid of the partitions, they would be able to sell a lot more alcohol, and that's why they want it gone. And so in as much as consumption impacts outcomes, which mm-hmm. is pretty clear that it does in the research, that should be enough evidence, I would think, from the people who are actually calling for the change, that there are going to be impacts if you get rid of the partition. Mm-hmm. And so now, I mean, I understand there's differences of opinion on this, yeah. and that's, you know, that's why we're having this discussion. But I don't think either side can really say, you know, you were just completely lacking data. Because,
yeah.
I mean, I guess we could say, well, what's your data to show that if you got rid of the partitions, it wouldn't have harmful impacts, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we mm-hmm. don't have that information either.
Yeah.
And so this is why, you know, we look more to where we do have data, which is about the whole system. And if the system is doing well in protecting public safety and public health while also providing reasonable access to alcohol, then I think it's incumbent upon those who want to change the system to say that we're not going to mess that up. And we have good information, we have good, strong arguments, we have good evidence showing that that's not going to happen. Because, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
You've said to us that some of the concerns of those who want to do away with this, Zion Curtain can be dealt with without, in fact, repealing the partition requirement.
Yeah.
Explain your idea there. This is, you say, raise the prices?
Yeah, well, I think that, again, if we are wanting to provide restaurants an opportunity to have a bar in their restaurant, then there's nothing that says fundamentally we have to then get rid of the partition. We could offer them an option of putting a bar in their restaurant that, and then while offering others the option to keep the partition. But I think in order for that to be an effective policy, you'd have to protect against the market forces. This gets back to the morphing issue, where people are wanting to be more like bars because they can make a lot of money that way. And if all your competitors are doing that, then it's going to be really hard for you not to do that. And so if that's, you know, if we're going to have that kind of system to be effective, then I think you have to put in some measures such as having higher prices on alcohol in the restaurants that have bars. And that actually makes sense from a public health and safety perspective, because if we're going to increase consumption, again, it's pretty clear that when you increase per capita consumption, the negative outcomes follow. And so that's basically saying if we're going to allow that to happen, then we're going to protect public health and safety, which is maintaining that balance that we have in Utah.
Do you have any opinion about there was a state audit released in the fall, and this is a contention you hear from critics of the system generally, that the amount of money that the state takes in from alcohol sales is not really going back into the department, that there's a lot of turnover with employees, that they're not treated all that well, certainly treated differently from other departments. Do you share those same kinds of concerns? Do you have any response to that?
You know, that's not an issue I'm personally that familiar with, other than what I've seen in the press and what I've heard. And, you know, if that stuff's happening, I mean, you know, we should be paying employees what we should be paying them, you know, what they're worth, certainly, and the value they create. I don't think there's any problem with improving how liquor stores are run and how they're managed. I mean, that's just kind of common sense. That's how we ought to be doing every office in the government, right? I mean, whether it be alcohol, public education, transportation, public safety.
There was a paper written for the Sutherland Institute, not by you, but one of your colleagues, who suggested that critics of the state's liquor laws need to come to terms with the culture of sobriety in this state, the fact that this is not a culture of drinking. This is Utah. It is what it is. It's not going to change. It's not a culture of drinking. And they're just going to sort of have to come to terms with it, with the difference. Do you share that idea?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I would put it in those terms. I think what the point is that there's political realities here in the state of Utah, and we can rail against those or we can try to work within them. And, you know, my personal take on that is we should try to work within them, you know, and try to get good stuff done, given the realities that we face. And this is, you know, true in any area of policy, I think. You know, you have to be realistic. And so, as it relates to alcohol, I think the reality that we face is we have a lot of people who their primary concern regarding alcohol is that they're protected from things like drunk driving, excessive drinking, you know, underage drinking. And then you have also a lot of people who simply want reasonable access to alcohol. And I think our laws are doing a pretty good job at making that balance.
It's Derek Monson, Public Policy Director at the Sutherland Institute. It's a Utah-based conservative public policy think tank. He joined us from his home in Farmington. Derek Monson, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you very much, Doug.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about not just the Zion Curtain, although that's an easy tease to get people interested. We're talking about the whole system of laws that govern the sale of alcohol in Utah. And the people who wrote these laws and those who support the rules say that they make practical sense. They're important in protecting public health. Others, though, say Utah's liquor laws aren't based on logic or data, just morality, or at least, a kind of misunderstanding about the culture of people who actually do like to drink or want to drink. Joining us now on the program is Jim DeBacchus. He is a Democrat in the state Senate. He represents the 2nd District. And Jim DeBacchus, thanks very much for coming in.
Always fun to be here.
I want to begin with how your perception of how this works. That is, how regulations get passed in this state related to alcohol or don't get passed, like how it works, because this is something that you've been somewhat, as an observer, critical of, or at least given us some sense of it. How does it work?
A lot of polls say somewhere between 65 and 75% of the people of the state want the Zion Curtain Wall taken down. They recognize the absurdity of it all. And it's been an interesting legislative occupation of mine to watch how it's possible that three quarters of the people of the state want something done and it doesn't happen. And it happens in a few areas, but this one is particularly interesting. When it comes to liquor, there are two important players here. It is whoever the legislative majority picks as their kind of liquor ambassador. It was Senator Valentine for a long time, and now it's my good friend Jerry Stevenson. And this is the liaison. And now it is a liaison both to the kind of drinking community, but more importantly, it's a liaison to the LDS Church. And the church, lest anybody think I'm picking on them, I mean, I'm actually surprised at how little impact they have on most everything that goes on in the legislature. I mean, they're not up there. They're not following bills. They pick a few areas, but in those areas, they decide.
Yeah.
And that's all there is to it.
And alcohol is one of them.
Alcohol is one of them.
All right.
My experience last year was, I'm bringing this bill to do away with the Zion Curtain. And I talked to Senator Stevenson, and he said, well, you know, we've already met.
And what did he mean by we?
He said he meant that he had met with the church and that they had decided that they were going to forego any discussion of that this year. And so the look was kind of, well, you know, you can do it, but I don't see any real reason to do it. And
how did you react to that?
I just rolled my eyes and said, well, Senator, you know, you got to do what you got to do. I'm going to get it out of rules. We're going to have a hearing and let everybody vote on it. And we will. And that's exactly what happened. But there was no chance it was going to pass. And this year, there's no chance it's going to pass. I mean, nothing is going to change in alcohol until the LDS Church kind of allows it to happen. And that's just the reality of the state. It's not anti-Mormon or pro-Mormon or anything. It's just the absolute truth.
In essence, what you're saying is that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints essentially has to sign off on legislation related to alcohol consumption.
And I think anybody
in a de facto way, like not in a – essentially they have to sign off. And they're not necessarily acting inappropriately or illegally. They have a right to express themselves, but essentially in a de facto way they have to sign off.
Like any other lobby group, they absolutely have the right. And anybody that says anything different is not telling the truth. I mean, that's just the reality. And you see people dance around it and you see a lot of, yeah, but, and blah, blah, blah. Well, look, it is what it is. And so we ought to smell the coffee.
Is it true on that line, DABC commissioners have to receive some sort of kind of de facto approval from the LDS Church?
I don't know. At one time, I think that was true. I don't know if it's still true.
To the argument that you hear that, look, okay, it may have been true, Senator DeBacchus, that it was hard to get a drink in this state. It may have been true that you used to have to get a weird club card, you know, be a private club member for a while. But come on. There are plenty of bars in this state. There are plenty of places you can get a drink. What do you say to that reaction? That this is sort of a silly overreaction.
I think it goes back to the fundamental issue about alcohol in the state. And there are a lot of people that just believe alcohol is inherently bad and always bad and that the world would be a better place without it. And they're not going to change their opinion. So
that it's immoral.
That it's immoral.
Yeah.
And that's where it comes down to. And so what I'm trying to point out continually is, look, we've already cross the Rubicon of we are going to serve alcohol. So we have two choices here. We have the road of public safety and the issues of public safety and the concerns of public safety, and we ought not to lower those standards a bit. We don't want 12-year-olds drinking, and go down the list, DUI and the rest. And I'm proud of the fact that Utah does quite well with alcohol abuse. But then we have a whole other category of the weirdness laws. And people stand...
Zion Curtain is one of these.
The Zion Curtain is one of them. Intent to Dine is another one. The amount of... we could go down a list.
And wait, what's 10 to Dine? What is that? Intent to Dine. Yeah.
So
they have to say, are you going to have food if you go into a restaurant in order for them to serve you something?
The agents for the DABC, and it has a tremendous amount of enforcement agents, many more than, I mean, that we should transfer money to the Highway Patrol, but that's a different issue. There's many, many, many. They don't have a lot to do. So the law says a person going into a restaurant must express an intent to dine, and it must be verbal. So people, the agents, the undercover agents were going in, and the hostess would say, here, would you like to sit down, and can I bring you a drink? And then saying, do you want to order some food? And it was, and they weren't getting it in the right order. And there were tremendous fines levied because they weren't passing this out. So you had a restaurant in Ogden that got fined a lot of money and would give to every single person coming in a little statement saying, I intend to dine, so they could give it back to the DABC. So now you have this subtle, you have to ask in a restaurant as you're waiting, did you intend to dine with us as you're bringing people to the table? Like, you know, it's a bowling alley. Do you intend to bowl, or are you just here to clean the lanes? That's another one of these goofball things that somehow people feel like if we're vigorous in protecting the public safety, we also have to protect all of these loopy leftover laws.
You're saying you can regulate alcohol, you're saying, but we don't need those strange laws. You can do away with them. And as you pointed out, if you believe that most Utahns think the Zion Curtain thing is dumb anyway.
Even virtually every category, Republicans, men, LDS, every category, the majority is in doing away with them. And it's just preposterous. And, you know, I did a little research to see where that whole thing came up. It goes back to a Tom Cruise movie, Cocktail.
What goes back to it? The
Zion Curtain.
Wow.
You know, there was a movie, I don't think it was all that big a movie, in the 80s, and Tom Cruise was this waiter who was juggling.
He was a bartender who did gymnastics with
like hibachi, you know. Right. And the legislators saw that and said, this is outrageous. We don't want to see people entertain, children in particular, so we'll put up these walls. Well, you know, Tom Cruise is not hot anymore. It's okay to change the law.
Do you dispute the evidence that the more you liberalize liquor laws, the more alcohol-related fatalities will go up, the more accidents and injuries will go up? Because one of the researchers who will join us shortly sort of makes this point that, look, making it less convenient to get alcohol by having fewer outlets just simply does reduce consumption, and that just by extension reduces harm.
Well, I suppose if we had one liquor store, you know, and we put it in Panguitch and then said, you know what, you can get alcohol, I'm not going to dispute that. That would seem to be self-evident. But there's a balancing act here. In a society where we say we want to give freedom to people and we want people to have opportunity and choice, even though we may have the moral value that that's nasty or mean or whatever, we need to make sure that public safety is taken care of, and then we need to recognize that there are others who have other values and other ideas and who like to have a drink, and they want to do it reasonably and responsibly, and this is about meeting their needs as well.
One of the things you've also suggested is that the way the state has managed regulations like the Zion Curtain, and let me talk about the Zion Curtain in particular, is kind of capricious. That if you're a restaurant like one of the restaurants, current restaurant downtown, They had a lot of difficulty with the DABC related to theirs. I guess what you're saying is this is indicative of how kind of capricious all of this is?
I'm saying when you have – this is a $400 million a year monopoly. This is on the level of the Soviet Union. And if you believe in free enterprise, if you believe monopolies are bad, if you believe that they produce the worst in servicing economy and in a lot of things, you're absolutely right. And there's no better example than this debacle of the DABC. If you look, since its founding, there's almost a regular cycle of scandals that come when you have a monopoly. They don't pay their workers anywhere near enough because there's no market forces. They don't take enough money out to look at the dumpy stores. That store does $13 million on 4th South and what is that, West Temple? Mm. Have you been in there? It's like a jail in there. And everything, it appears, to be decorated and done in a way to make people feel as though they're committing a sin or a crime, or that, you know, they don't want people, like it should be an embarrassment to go there. Now, that's not true with all liquor stores. I mean, there's some newer ones that are a little sunshinier and brighter. But if anybody had a store that was doing $13 million a year, would they keep it in that location with that kind of thing, with a turnover that's on the range of 60% a year? This is not the way logical, reasonable people would run a business. We got to get rid of this monopoly.
I just want to mention also that this is not just Senator DeBaca's going off about the DABC, that there was a state audit that came out in the fall that did talk about – that was critical of some of the things that you were mentioning. Turnover comes up, it seems like, time and time again. You've also said that DABC employees are not looked on as state employees, that they're kind of looked on with a kind of disdain.
Stepchildren. I mean, there's people that have been working for the DABC for 20 years, making $10.86 an hour. There is a because of this tremendous turnover. I mean, when you go into a job at $9.60 an hour, you're not looking for a career. You're looking to stay there until you can get something that's decent. So when you do go into a liquor store, all too often you're faced with people that have no idea about the product and no incentive to know about it. And maybe that goes back to this, if we only have one wine store and it's in Panguitch, maybe if we have employees that we incentivize to know nothing about the product, that will bring about less liquor consumption. But that's a very rude way to run a business. If we're in there, we ought not to run it that way.
You have suggested that the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control do away with it, privatize the sale of alcohol in the state is what you've said.
Yeah, what do we need Big Brother state government running it for? I mean, I thought the state has a whole commission and they meet very punctually. It's called the Free Market Protection and Privatization Board, and they're constantly looking. We can save $1,000 here or $500 here. Let's privatize this and that. They refuse to have a hearing on the $400 million gorilla. I keep saying, look, you guys, let's have a – this is privatization that we really need to be talking about. Won't even talk about it. It ought to be there, and it ought to be in steps. We ought to go to wine first. So let's go to Trader Vic's. Let's go to Smith's. Let's have a wine kind of store inside.
Did you mean Trader Joe's?
Trader Joe's, yeah. Trader Vic's. That would give us a terrific opportunity to not spend millions and millions of dollars in capital to build more stores, more facilities. The state would make a lot more money. We wouldn't need all those warehouses. Just put a tax on it. Voila, it just makes sense.
But here's the sort of argument from a researcher sort of point of view, because there have been states, and this is going to come up a little bit later in the program, where they have allowed private companies to, you know, sell, where they used to be state institutions, they privatized basically. And what happened in pretty much all of the cases is because they're now allowed to market, sales go up. When sales go up, bad outcomes go up as well. So what do you make of that? How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I don't know how to respond to it because I don't think it's good that people overdrink. I mean, we don't know that the added sales are added public safety hazards. All we know is that people are drinking more, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they're drinking irresponsibly more. It just means that there's more alcohol. So, I mean, you'd not need to dive into the numbers.
Let me ask you this finally. It seems like the cultural dimension here is sort of this is how we began, with the fact that the LDS Church seems to, on some indirect way, dictate alcohol policy. You've said this isn't about Republican or Democratic inclinations; it's about the LDS Church. So, is that sort of cultural component something that's going to just sort of remain, or do you see any movement whatsoever with, like, for example, within church leaders maybe suggesting, okay, we need to keep strong policies in place, but we can get rid of some of the weirder stuff?
Yeah, I think that's the near-term thing that happens. What's frustrating, I think, for a lot of non-LDS people that are my constituents is that they don't feel as if they have any input in on it. That is, if it is a conversation between a senator and a House representative in the church discussing it, and then they come out and that's decided for the year, it feels as if if the church wants to make that decision, they should have an open hearing and let a lot of other people in to say, you know what, have you thought about this, or have you thought about that, or have you thought about the next thing? And that by opening up the process a little bit, if that's what we're stuck with, if that's the way it's going to work, look, I don't begrudge them having on these very few issues this strong say. But as we did with the LGBT thing, I would hope that they would open it up, get some real communication with some people that actually drink, with some people that have restaurants, and I think that would lead to not only better policies, but also better feelings in the community.
Is there any of that going on?
Yeah, I think to some extent. I think Michael Purdy and the people, I brought them out to...
You're talking about the church.
Yeah, yeah. I think it is, and I'm proud of that. I think there needs to be more of it.
Senator Jim DeBacchus, he is the Democratic Senator for Utah's 2nd Legislative District, joined us here in the studio. Senator, good to see you. Thanks very much.
Always fun.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the logic or the data behind Utah's liquor laws. A lot of people talk about the Zion Curtain, for example, but there are a lot of sort of questions about things that drive Utah's policy in general. We've been talking a little bit about that. Joining us now is Alex Wagenaar, who is an epidemiologist and a research professor at Emory University, the Rollins School of Public Health, where, among other things, he studies the impact of alcohol laws and regulation on public health. He's joining us from his home in the Tampa Bay area in Florida. And Professor Wagenaar, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
I'm pleased to be here.
I guess I wanted to begin with a cultural component, although you don't have a lot sort of research to talk about in that way. But just, I guess I wanted to begin with, because it seems like it's such a cultural question in a lot of places, certainly here in Utah. Should, I guess, or does culture play a role in these kinds of things? And what do you make of that? It's hard to measure that, I suppose.
Well, yeah, it's a big question. I mean, this has been a fascinating conversation so far, and I don't know that much about the details of all the politics in Utah. But this broader cultural question and what's the role of laws and regulations, I think it's important to kind of think that through and think anytime we're having a law or regulation on something, we're trying to keep air pollution down or we're trying to have safe cars or whatever we're doing, you know, there's always these two effects. And laws and regulations of alcohol particularly illustrate that. Mm. because the regulations can directly lower the accessibility of alcohol and make it a little more expensive, a little bit harder to get, and that lowers how much people buy, and it lowers how much people drink a little bit, and that leads to some savings in terms of the health problems. But there's also a second thing of the law, and that's how it shapes social norms.
Right.
And that's kind of the cultural effect. So when you have a well-regulated alcohol sales system, it's society, it's the community saying alcohol is not like a normal product. It's not like your fruits and veggies, where we want entrepreneurs to sell them as efficiently as possible. We want great availability that you can just run down to the corner and you can get all these healthy foods at the cheapest price possible. Well, alcohol is different. We're making it available to people. We want to have kind of a balanced system, but we're going to try to tampen down the hazards and the harm that we know that alcohol creates. And the laws and regulations shape that culture, as well as, of course, the culture shapes the laws, and it kind of goes both ways. It's easier to have a tight regulatory system when the public or the environment is maybe more concerned about alcohol than in some other states.
This may seem like a sort of dumb, easy, obvious question, but let's think in terms of a wet culture and a dry culture. I think people know the distinction. Is a dry culture, does it have fewer bad outcomes, fewer drunk driving fatalities, fewer accidents, fewer incidents, fewer cases of alcoholism? Can we just say that straight out?
Well, those are, I mean, that's all a question of how you're going to define a drier culture versus a wetter culture. You know, I'm an epidemiologist, so we basically spend our lives counting the dead bodies and trying to figure out how to lower that death rate, or we count the injuries or the hospitalizations or the disease cases or the new infections, and we try to figure out how to lower those rates. And that's where the science shows us a lot of these effects. And that's why this discussion, I think, is so important. We have 50 years of research, hundreds and hundreds of studies of components of these alcohol laws and regulations. And the aggregate of all that research shows very clearly that when you have a well-regulated market, when you have a state monopoly with relatively fewer stores rather than convenience stores on every corner selling liquor, you know, the whole totality, when you keep the price relatively high, just, you know, not extreme, but you have good, pretty high taxes on alcohol, you keep the price up a bit, those things all reduce how much people drink, and that ripples through because you're shaping the whole population of drinkers. Everybody's at slightly lower risk, and then that reflects when you look at the death rates of a 5 or 10% lower rate of fatal car crashes or cirrhosis, new cirrhosis diagnoses, liver cirrhosis or alcohol-related cancer or whatever you're looking at.
You say that one of the things that's been studied the most is the effect of prices and taxes. Maybe take that. What impact does pricing, does taxing alcohol have in the scheme of things?
Yeah, there's a lot of literature on this. We've conducted meta-analyses on this and of over 1,000 estimates of the effect of the alcohol tax and or price, they're kind of closely related to each other, on drinking. And basically the summary of all that research shows pretty clearly that if you increase the price by 10%, it leads to about a 5 to 8% decrease in the consumption of alcohol. And that those price changes, and these are all controlled studies, you know, that are done over the last 50 years as states tweak their taxes and then people evaluate it and they have control states. Other states didn't tweak their alcohol taxes. So there's a lot of controlled studies, and they show that the price doesn't just affect a certain kind of drinker. It really affects the whole population of drinkers, from the people who are really heavy or excessive drinkers to those who drink pretty lightly. And it just sort of shifts everything down a little bit. So the person that is really at extreme risk and they're drinking whatever, 12 drinks a day, they got a very serious alcohol problem. Well, it gets a little more expensive. They might drink only 11 drinks a day, and that lowers their risk of death, lowers their risk of disease. the person that's out driving after having a few drinks, well, instead of having 4, 5, or 6, you know, say they have 6 before they drive. Now, it's a little more expensive, and they only have 5. It's not like it's eliminating a problem, but it's lowering the risk by 5-10%, and then across the whole state, across all the millions of people in the state, across all of the years, you see that reflected in injury rates, disease rates, and death rates.
Let me ask you about something you've also mentioned. You sort of referred to it earlier, and that is sort of the number of places where a person can get a drink in a place. You've said that the research shows making it less convenient to get a drink reduces the harms and the consumption, I guess. I guess that seems self-evident, but what have you found about that?
Well, a lot of this does seem self-evident, but it's interesting that people argue with it all the time, and they want to say it doesn't. It's not true. The taxes don't really matter. People are going to drink whatever they want. And, you know, if you interview a drinker and say, well, you know, the price is going to go up by 10 cents or 20 cents or 50 cents, is it going to change how much you drink? And people will say, well, no, I've got enough money. It's not going to make any difference. But when we look at it across the whole population, across the whole year or whatever, then and do that carefully with a scientifically designed study, that's when you see the effects. Now, this whole area of density of outlets is another one like that. The economists just think of this as another cost thing. They would say, well, that's the same principle. And then non-economists tend more to talk about convenience or accessibility. But if you have to drive further to get a drink, it's a little bit more inconvenient. It's just another factor that just dampens down the drinking rate a bit, and then it's reflected in these health outcomes. And of course, you can think of particular scenarios where that's really important. You know, the college students that are having a drinking party and everything is going, and after they start drinking, it gets wilder and wilder, and this is particularly a problem, but then people want to drink more after they've already been drinking. I mean, it's kind of classic part of the problem. So then it's 11 or midnight. They got to run out to the liquor store to get a few more, quarts of vodka and gin or whatever to keep the party going. Well, if there's not a liquor store down at the corner that they can run to, or it closes at 9 or 10 p.m. or something, well, that's just one example of just one case. But from the epidemiologist's point of view, there's thousands of those little situations that occur across a state or across the country kind of every night. They kind of add up over the course of time. And then when you look at a chunk of time across the whole population, you can see these benefits in terms of health outcomes and healthcare cost savings. And they really add up. You know, it's an effective alcohol regulatory system saves thousands of lives and many millions of dollars in healthcare costs, because the people that are injured or the people that fall or the people that are in a fight or a bar brawl or whatever, they all go to the emergency departments. I mean, it's all part of our system, and we're paying that. And if we can reduce it by 10%, it's a social good to most people.
What can an epidemiologist say to a rule like the Zion Curtain? The idea that just by exposing young people to someone behind a bar making a drink somehow has some correlative effect on consumption. Can you say anything about that?
Well, yeah, that's this issue of like disaggregating it to every little piece. I mean, I've not studied these design curtains, and I really don't know of any epidemiologists that look specifically at design curtains. And it seems like they're kind of a unique Utah kind of feature. But there are psychologists and social psychologists that have looked at kind of related things. So there's a literature on children and as children move towards adolescence and how they learn about alcohol and how they view it. And so there's literature there that children that are exposed to a lot of advertising and a lot of alcohol in their environment, and they have a lot of positive images associated with alcohol that makes you successful, makes you attractive, and so forth, that they report then more favorable attitudes around alcohol, or they're a little more likely to say that if given the opportunity, they would try a drink if there was alcohol when they get to high school or they're whatever, if they were, if it was there. So there's a whole literature like that that is not the kind of research that I personally do, but I've read some of those studies, and it's a little softer. You don't have a disease or an infection or an injury to count specifically, so it's a little harder to specify exactly what those effects are. But it's a reasonable assumption if you expose people to a lot of positive images around alcohol that they become more positively disposed to it. And then as they get older and get access to it at a party or somewhere, even if they're underage, they're more likely to think that they would try it. Hmm.
We're essentially out of time, but with a minute or so left, I wonder, are you seeing more better conversations about this kind of thing? You talk about it being important that we should be having these kinds of conversations. Are you seeing more of this or not enough from your perspective?
Well, as a country, basically, most of what we've been doing the last couple of decades is gradually deregulating alcohol. I was a little bit concerned in the show a little bit earlier that the gentleman's talking about eliminating the state monopoly. And sure, there might be problems in management or whatever. I have no idea how the Utah system is run. But again, we have research that when stuff moves from a state monopoly system, which isn't designed to maximize sales, and you give it to a private entity, which is designed to maximize sales, you naturally get a significant jump in store sales. And when states moved wine out of their state liquor stores in the past and put it in private stores, many states double their sales of wine, double. So the question about balance is, does a state want to double its alcohol sales? And are they ready to deal with those consequences? Or, it's like, that's the balance. How are we going to attenuate and just kind of keep a reasonable system where people who want to get access can get access without generating undue kind of mayhem or crashes or disease effects down the line?
That's Alex Wagenaar, an epidemiologist and research professor at Emory University Rollins School of Public Health. Professor, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.